If you love coffee, then you probably know that the secret to making a great cup of coffee is starting with freshly roasted beans. But you have no idea when the coffee from the grocery store was roasted, which puts you in a bit of a tight spot. As a matter of fact, your situation is pretty nigh hopeless. But I'd like to address your general attitude of hopeless negativism and look at Sparkplug Coffee as your paradigm of hope. Sparkplug is premium and fair trade. They offer blends and roasts to suit any taste, even decaf and half calf. But what really makes Sparkplug special is that they deliver this outstanding coffee to you in Canada or the US within 1 week of custom roasting it here in Toronto so that it reaches you fresh and at its peak flavor, and you will taste the difference. You can order Sparkplug a la carte, or you can join the Autopilot Coffee Club. It's not a coffee of the month club. Nope, it's completely flexible and customizable. All the convenience, none of the commitment. And if you use the promo code TOP100PROJECT at checkout, and that's all one word with a number 100, Sparkplug will give you 20% off your next coffee order. So what are you waiting for? Get yourself cleaned up, get a little smell-em in your hair, and go to sparkplugcoffee.com.
I am a man who has a coffee sponsor. That's good enough.
Top 100.
Top 100.
Top 100.
Project.
And action.
Hello, you hayseeds who think the law is a human institution. And gol darn, ain't we obliged that you're spending a bit of your day hearing the Ellis's analysis. For the 369th time, we're here to talk about motion pictures. Want to hear about the AFI classics from their 1998 and 2007 Top 100 lists? Well, sir, you're in luck, because we reviewed all of those years ago. Those are spoiler-laden. This one will be, too. I'm the lying, unconstant succubus, who isn't too handy with the metallurgic arts, but who often finds himself in a tight spot. Ryan Ellis. And here is my sunshine, my only sunshine. The bona fide lady who used to put smell-em in her hair before the pandemic because she's a Dapper Dan man. Not so much smell-em the last 9 months, though. My wife, Bev.
That's me.
My hair. The coming attractions trivia for Oh Brother, Where Art Thou is such an easy one. Where does the title, Oh Brother, Where Art Thou, come from?
Well, easy for us. I don't know if this would be easy for most people.
Gotta be a buff then, yeah.
Yeah, yeah. It comes from the movie Sullivan's Travels, that Preston Sturges movie, which we covered years ago now because it's on the 2007 AFI list. Mm-hmm. I hated it, but... Mm-hmm. The lead character is Joel McRae, who's a director of comedies who wants to make serious films. And the film he's trying to get made is based on a fictional book, and it's called Oh Brother, Where Art Thou? But then, of course, by the end of the movie, he figures out that comedy is more uplifting to help the poor than movies about the poor, I guess.
Laughs lifted me. Yeah, he goes to jail and sees how much power comedy has when they're watching, I think, cartoon shorts, especially Mickey Mouse, Goofy. And the irony is that the Coens still did comedies after this, and some of their weakest ones, in fact, a few years after this. Man Who Wasn't There was pretty damn good. But then when they got into
Intolerable Cruelty,
right,
and Lady Killers.
Right. Not bad, but by their standards, not so great. But then after that was actually a pretty serious film with some black humor, I guess.
No Country. Very black humor.
No Country for Old Men. They won the Oscar for them. They won three that night. But they didn't keep on doing serious dark films. They've made lots of comedies, like Burn After Reading, since No Country, and so on. So they're not doing what Joel McRae wanted to do. They're realizing what Joel McRae realized in that movie. Okay, Donde Está Hermano was released by Touchstone Pictures and Universal 20 years ago in late December 2000, and that was, I think I mentioned this before, one of my favorite triple headers going to the movies of all time. I haven't had that many, but the two most memorable were in that same year. The summer I saw, maybe the fall, but anyway, I saw Almost Famous, Nurse Betty, and The Exorcist re-released the same day. This one was, and it got better as it went along, Finding Forrester, which was fine. This movie, which I liked more, and then Traffic was later that night before I went to work on New Year's Eve. Very memorable triple header for me.
Hey, since we've recently rewatched Traffic, would you still put it in that order? You still think Traffic is a better movie than Oh Brother?
Better, but I'd rather rewatch this. If it's one of those pare down your collection and you can only keep a certain amount of movies and the other ones have to go, if it came down to these two, then I'd probably keep Oh Brother, but I think Traffic's a better and certainly more important movie. But I do like this one a lot.
It's funny talking about Soderbergh, too, because I'd say Oh Brother and Out of Sight were probably the two movies that got George Clooney off on his way to true movie stardom. Ocean's 11, another Soderbergh film, is probably the movie that really turned him into a movie star.
He got this because of Out of Sight. The Coens liked him in that a lot. Maybe they'd seen ER too, but especially Out of Sight. And Clooney is one of those guys who broke that mold of a TV actor can't be a movie star. Why would you pay for a guy if you can see him on TV? Although he'd quit the show to be a movie star. But he did Out of Sight, and he did, what did he do in 99? There's something in there. Three Kings, which we covered last year. And then this, and The Perfect Storm this year, which was a big hit. You mentioned Ocean's 11, also a big hit.
It wasn't a foregone conclusion that he would be a movie star, because his first feature film that I remember was One Fine Day, and then he was Batman in Batman and Robin. Mm-hmm. And nobody really liked those movies or him in them. It honestly seemed like maybe he'd made a mistake because he was such a hit as Dr. Doug Ross on ER. He did a lot of TV before that, too, because he was also in Roseanne and Facts of Life.
And other movies that no one really saw long before any of this stuff. But it was really smart to work with, A, the Coens, which he did without reading the script, he said. And also working with the Coens to give you that credibility, ironically, by being silly. It's not like working with Scorsese or Ingmar Bergman or someone and doing a very serious role, and now I'll be taken seriously. It's the reverse. He did the serious role on TV with ER. Out of Sight, it's a comedy, but it's a dramedy, really, in a way. Let me be silly and stupid for an hour and 40-plus minutes, and that's what's going to get me credibility. Maybe he didn't think of it that way, but that's what happened.
Who could have had the vision to think that Clooney could pull this off? Because he is so funny, and I don't know if I've ever seen him do this kind of thing before. You could say yes since, but truly only in Coen films. I'm thinking of Intolerable Cruelty and Burn After Reading. Both those movies he plays this very silly, over-the-top goofball character.
The Idiot Trilogy is what Clooney is called.
Yeah.
Also he was in, why am I forgetting the name of it, a couple years ago, Hail Caesar.
The only movie that knocks Lady Killers out of the running for worst Coen film.
Still has good stuff in it though.
I have to watch it a second time because it's a Coen film and I've got to give it another chance. But I did not like it.
Oh Brother doubled its budget domestically and did even better worldwide. The soundtrack especially, as people may remember, was a monster hit. It sold 5 million copies on CD back when that was a thing.
Remember when that could happen?
And it won Grammys.
Yeah, it won Album of the Year, which I thought was something remarkable. But then I looked it up and actually lots of soundtracks or compilations have won Album of the Year. Saturday Night Fever, The Bodyguard both did.
And then a lot of soundtracks that aren't, what do you want to call them, lyric-filled songs, have won Grammys, I believe. I think John Williams has done that many times over the years. But we're not talking about Saturday Night Fever with the disco songs or the songs in this film. So, yeah, you can win Grammys anyway without actually having a lyric-filled song. But, of course, this movie does. This is not a musical, but there's a lot of music in it.
You could borderline call this movie a musical. Music is such an important part of it.
They're saved by music. Okay, Bev, please read the skinny on Oh Brother, Where Art Thou?
All right. George Clooney, Tim Blake Nelson, and John Turturro are Everett, Delmar, and Pete, three escaped convicts in Mississippi during the Great Depression. They're on their way to recover a treasure in Everett's hometown. On the journey, the three men have a series of challenges and adventures. They make friends. They make enemies. They record a hit song. And they get the treasure. Well, not that treasure. Another treasure. The treasure of friendship and family. And some money, too. Don't worry.
Also the wrong ring. The real treasure. Do not seek the treasure. We thought you was a toad. That's a play in a very famous sketch from Taxi. A friend of mine, Frank, did that for one of our school projects one time where he had a guy repeating a line over and over again, which is a play on something in Taxi where Jim says something because he thinks the guy doesn't understand. Fittingly, too, Delmar and Everett have gone to see a Three Stooges movie because these three guys are definitely the Three Stooges. Tommy may be the fourth, who's in the movie with them a lot, and is obviously a member of the Soggy Bottom Boys, and supposedly two other guys, too, for that matter, that they get money for who aren't actually there. But for most of the movie, it's the three guys, and they are the Three Stooges. Or, in a nutshell, flower salesman hires dim felons to help win gubernatorial honors, or re-win, as it were, because Pape O'Dano is running for re-election. And he is a flower salesman. You see bags of flour on the train when Clooney gets on. And any of you fellas talented in the metallurgical arts before he gets pulled off the train. That was in the trailer.
So funny.
A lot of the goofy faces were when he falls down but then gets yanked out because Pete has fallen and he's pulled Delmar. The scene where he stands up and it's the, I thought it'd be the fellow with the capacity for abstract thought as to why he'd be the leader and not the other two. But yeah, the trailer is filled with Clooney looking silly, which was obviously part of the appeal. You know, it's a Coen Brothers film. Lebowski wasn't a big hit, but it was only 2 years before. Fargo was 4 years before. That was a pretty good-sized hit. Won Oscars. Both were comedies. The Coens were certainly known for their comedies. And if you're going to use George Clooney, you might as well sell the fact that he's not doing what you think he's going to do in Out of Sight and Three Kings and the TV show. He's being goofy, so let's really feature that. Plus, as you said before, we covered Three Kings only last fall. What a handsome man.
He's so easy on the eyes. If you were just going to have a contest for who the straight-up hottest movie star ever was, he'd be in the top five.
And he's gotten better looking as he's gone along. Maybe not so much now that he's gotten to be mid-50s, I guess, but around this point when he was already 40-ish, I think. What a dreamboat. And also Brad Pitt, another guy in Burn After Reading, who's so great in that film, who can lampoon himself and have fun, who could have gone the I'm a serious actor route. But neither of them did that, really, for the most part. And I really appreciate that. Clooney, though, hasn't acted that much the last decade or so. He's produced things. He's got two Oscars, one for supporting actor, one for producing Argo. He's directed. He's got a movie coming out. Well, it would have been in the theaters, but now it'll just be probably on demand. But I really appreciate the fact that those two guys could have coasted on their obvious talents, but also their looks. And neither of them really did, especially around the late 90s, early 2000s. And worked together, of course, in the Three Oceans films and seemed to be buddies. Okay, the Rotten Tomatoes numbers in this movie are not wonderful, but they're okay. 77% of critics like the film, 117 fresh, 34 rotten, for an average of 7.2 out of 10, and 89% of audiences. The film was 55th at the 2000 U.S. box office. We've covered a lot of movies from that year. The Grinch was number one. That's the Jim Carrey movie, of course. Gladiator was number four. We covered that earlier this year. Crouching Tiger, Hidden Dragon, we covered, I think it was last year, was 12th. And Traffic, all three of those were Best Picture nominees. That was 15th, and that was covered earlier this year by us, too. Oh Brother was nominated for two Oscars, the adapted screenplay by the Coens, the first time they ever adapted a screenplay, and of course they won the Oscar for adapting No Country for Old Men 7 years later.
Technically, it's an adaptation, but even they admitted they never read the book.
I really wonder about that. I've read that for years, too, online. There are so many comparisons, and I don't know much about The Odyssey, but so many comparisons to it. And we'll talk about those a little bit as the podcast plays out. And people can read more about that online if they want to. That I really doubt that they didn't read it all. These guys like to play the press a lot of times when they do their promotional stuff for movies. I think they were just pulling people's legs. Clooney didn't win the Oscar. Wasn't even nominated for the Oscar. But he did win the Golden Globe. I watched that speech last night. Although the online thing cuts it off. You only see part of it. And as gracious and funny as you'd expect from him. He was after Jim Carrey's two straight wins. Although Carrey was a comedy and drama. I forget what the order was there. But they both said in their, I think, comedy wins. Because Clooney, of course, was comedy. He was up against Cusack in High Fidelity, Carrey and the Grinch, and a couple other big names. And saying, well, who would have thought those guys have a chance against me? Because, of course, he was the lesser known compared to them. And they had accomplished so much in their careers. And Oh Brother was nominated for the Top 100 Songs. Again, a song that should have made that list. But it did not. It is not original, but that doesn't really matter. The song, Man of Constant Sorrow, was first sung in 1913 by Dick Burnett, so almost 100 years before. And the film couldn't have made the Top 100 Laughs list, couldn't even get nominated, because that show was released in 2000, the same year as this movie. Okay, well, I guess we've already talked about what we think. I think you're a fan of this movie, too. Go ahead. Are you? Are you not?
Yeah, I love this movie. I was surprised to see it didn't do better on Rotten Tomatoes and Metacritic and stuff. I find it's a lot like The Big Lebowski in the way that it gets funnier every time I watch it. And the performances are just out of this world across the board. Everybody is so funny in the movie. I always think of Fargo, Big Lebowski, and Oh Brother as this trilogy. Mm-hmm. I don't really know why I necessarily associate those three Coen films together. And then it's like he made a break when he made The Man Who Wasn't There, which I love. I actually think it's a way underrated Coen film that none of
people
have
seen. But it's not goofy comedy. And Big Lebowski
and
even Fargo are pretty goofy. Hudsucker Proxy before Fargo is goofy too, but it isn't as good.
They really came up in Fargo. It seemed like the movie where people suddenly really started taking them very seriously. Yes, feels like they fell off, at least comedy-wise. I was thinking about why that was, because Lady Killers strangely felt like such a departure from what they were making before, just in quality, and everybody kind of agreed about that. But I thought Lady Killers and Intolerable Cruelty, they both share that comic sensibility that Oh Brother has.
There's still laughs in those movies,
and
it's very watchable.
It's very goofy, but I guess the difference might be that it doesn't have Oh Brother's darkness. Oh Brother has like a real vein of misery and sadness that...
Constant Sorrow?
constant sorrow. Yes, there's something really pitiable about their lives. And that tone isn't in those other comedies. And I wonder if that's what makes Oh Brother a better film.
Lady Killers is about villains for the most part. Tom Hanks playing a rare villain.
Yeah, the only Coen film he's ever been in, right?
Mm-hmm. Intolerable Cruelty has not full-on villains, but it isn't the greatest movie of all time. There's one huge laugh towards the end of that movie, though. Of course, No Country. A lot of people in that film, the main characters especially, well, two of the three main characters, not Tommy Lee Jones. He's a good cop doing his job. But Llewellyn Moss and obviously Anton Chigurh are not heroes, so it's not entirely that. Who has ever been perfect at making comedies? Some of the great comedic directors and actors and writers of all time have probably more than their fair share of duds on their resume. To have even done 4 to 10 bona fide, really, truly long-lasting comedies. And the Coens' percentage is better than that. But if you only did 4 to 10, like the old guys we said, Preston Sturges, probably less percentage than that, although The Lady Eve is great. Sullivan's Travels has aged not so well. So I don't know what the answer is, but when you're talking about the great directors, the Coens are certainly in that category. This was still, by the way, listed as Joel Coen directing, Ethan Coen producing, and them both writing together. But as we've now learned, I guess all along, they both directed, they both produced, and of course they both wrote, but they only had one director credit. I think it was one of the next couple of movies they did. Maybe it was Intolerable Cruelty, where they were both credited as directors. But as for this movie being better than the ones that followed, Man Who Wasn't There is close to this, but the other ones that followed soon after are not so much. Flip a coin. This movie could have failed badly. Those movies could have succeeded really well, especially when, if you think about it, he's casting even bigger stars. Hanks, especially, in Lady Killers, and then Clooney, not at this point, but 3 years later.
With Catherine Zeta-Jones
coming off an Oscar, are bigger players than the people in this movie. Clooney at this point and his co-stars. Hail Caesar is filled with great actors and great stars. And it's just okay.
Yeah, comedy is the genre where you really have to catch lightning in a bottle. You can put the greatest talent together and still make a dud. Although, even the worst Coen film is still a Coen film. It's still better than a lot of the trash.
Mm-hmm.
We watched My Best Friend's Wedding yesterday. That movie was a hit. I recall liking it at the time, and I don't know what compelled me to want to watch it again last night, but God, it's bad. It is not funny. Worst out of anything. Rupert Everett is the only good thing in it.
Mm-hmm.
Julia Roberts' charm definitely propels it at least to the finish line.
But other than that,
everything else is just dragging it down. I couldn't believe how poorly that film has aged.
She and Dermot Mulroney are hateable in that movie. Just completely hate-worthy. The way it's written, it's not their fault.
Yeah. Cameron Diaz, who they keep talking about how perfect she is, she's pretty freaking annoying, actually.
Mm. Good example. That movie was a big hit. And it was bad. I said to you when it was over, it was almost as bad as How to Lose a Guy in 10 Days. And that's saying something.
So, yeah, these are movies that were hits. And
it was a hit.
It was a hit. The worst Coen film is still a country mile better than either of those movies.
So this starts out with the chant from the chain gang. And that was apparently actually from a recording of a real chain gang. And that's impressive because it sounds great.
That's a real recording?
That's what I read. That's one of those things you read and think, that doesn't sound true to me, because it really rings the whole room, our surround sound system. Not that we have the best surround sound system in the world, but it was one of the best sounding moments in the entire film.
I love the soundtrack to this film.
You don't necessarily just mean music. You're talking about the actual sound design, right?
Oh, well, yeah, it's all outstanding, but I just mean the soundtrack, the album I listened to.
Of course, yeah.
And that track, Poe Lazarus, the song is called. There's just something so haunting about it. The ways just their voices and the rocks breaking. And I find it incredibly moving. I've listened to that song a lot of times. They must have either done a magnificent job mastering it or they just copied it. I cannot imagine how that was originally recorded in the 30s.
The internet's often wrong, so maybe they're wrong again here.
I could totally buy that they based it, that they were just trying to mimic a recording they heard, and they did such an excellent job. I always find that recording particularly, I don't know, special. So much about the soundtrack is its rawness. There are lots of songs that are pretty polished, but then there's lots of songs that just feel so rough around the edges, like you were really there and the fiddle is just a little bit out of tune and the singers, they kind of sound like amateurs, but there's just so much joy and authenticity.
Soul and passion.
Soul and passion and the darkness of the film comes through in the music. There's some sunny songs, You Are My Sunshine, or Look on the Sunny Side of Life, or In the Highways. For each song that's cheerful like that, there is a plaintive song. There's the blues, there's the true misery of the time and place of the depression in the South, or music of the black people that lived there at the time. And that suffering and melancholy comes through so clearly in the music.
Well, we've got three white guys in a black chain gang, which is interesting because the majority of people we see are black.
They're the only white people in that chain gang.
Okay, well, the only ones then. How did no one see them running away?
I know.
Maybe it's a subtle hint saying, well, if it's white guys running away, oh, well, fine, let them go. If they were black, they'd be shot dead.
It deals with racism, although in a cutesy Hollywood way.
The Coens are not known for being equal opportunity guys. Their next movie is supposed to be, and God knows when it'll ever come out now, something with Denzel Washington in the lead role. And that's probably deliberate because I don't think you could call these guys racist. If they are, then I've never heard an actual story that says the Coens said the N-word, the Coens did this. But most of their movies have been extremely white. They're in some ways the Woody Allen of the Midwest. So many of their films have been set either in Minnesota or in this case Mississippi, that's the Deep South. But the heartland type filmmakers who don't see race because everybody's white in their movies.
Yeah, yeah. But where did you hear the phrase inclusion rider for the first time?
Joel Coen's wife.
Yep.
Frances McDormand at the Oscars when she won for Three Billboards a couple years ago.
Yeah, you can't deny that she would have influence and that she would see that criticism and push them to change the way they behave.
But they're not white Christians. They're Jewish filmmakers. That was not something I knew until more recently. Of course, A Serious Man's all about a Jewish guy.
The Jewish arc, really.
The whole arc of the film, yeah. So they've dealt with their own what have you in Hollywood and the world, I'm sure, by being Jewish people.
Well, growing up in, where are they from again?
They're from Minnesota,
yeah, they're from Minnesota. So when they made Fargo, part of that was an insult to Minnesota because they just always felt like such outcasts there being Jewish.
The polite hostility, which we have in Canada, too. The Minnesota nice is also Canada nice in a lot of ways.
Mm-hmm.
And let's not forget, too, because when she won the Oscar, I don't think I'd ever seen this before, but because Joel is there sitting beside her, so is their adopted son, who is, I guess, Hispanic. So that's cool that they adopted somebody who's not white as well. Maybe that was a deliberate choice. So anyway, yeah, they've been accused of that kind of thing. But this movie does deal with race in plenty of ways. Our three heroes are not racist. They accept Tommy right away. Chris Thomas King only made one other movie. So he's Tommy in this movie. He was in Ray. He's a Grammy Award winning blues artist. So he's actually, I think, supposed to be playing the guitar when they're singing Into the Can for Stephen Root's character, recurring Coen actor as well, much like Clooney is. And he's playing in the big show at the end. But they're friends with him. They accept him right away. But he tells them as well, we talk about the darkness in this movie, he tells them right away that he sold his soul to the devil on the crossroads where they meet him.
Well, he wasn't using it.
But they save him from a KKK rally, which is played off for comedy. Wizard of Oz leanings in there. I was reading in the research for this, and there's plenty of stuff online about this movie, that the Coens are like Lynch. So many films he's made, he has said, have been influenced by The Wizard of Oz. Everything I do is Wizard of Oz-like. At least in his opinion, themes and what. Probably the weirdness, I guess, for him too. And the Coens have their own kind of weirdness, not quite as surreal as Lynch or even Wizard of Oz. But there are some things in this, including the three guys dressing up to try to save somebody from something, like in Wizard of Oz, where it's the Tin Man, the Cowardly Lion, and the Scarecrow that do that to save Dorothy. But it's nice that they have this theme of this young black guy, like he even says, I didn't do nothing to you, neither you gentlemen. And his three friends, who don't really know him that well, are risking their lives to save his. And why is he being strung up? Just because he's black. Although Pete was going to be strung up and killed even before that.
Well, for being an escaped convict and for having information that they were trying to get out of him. And if he were black, they would have just strung him up. They probably would not have let him live. And I say that the way they deal with racism is kind of a cutesy Hollywood way of dealing with racism because all the racists are in the KKK and
they all get theirs.
They all get theirs. Yeah. What does he say? You've made a mockery of a burning cross, or you desecrated a burning cross. That's it. And then they're rejected for being racist.
Okay.
At the end
do
of
the
you
film. Really think that in- crowd, because music saves these guys' lives more than once. Do you think that crowd would have been that cool with integration just because they love Man of Constant Sorrow?
In Mississippi in the 30s. And then you find out that the gubernatorial candidate is in the KKK. That doesn't even hurt candidates now.
It benefits them in some ways.
Right. So It's cutesy in the way that they're very optimistic about the way that people feel that they would, yeah, forgive. What's the word? Miscegenation?
Is that miscegenation.
It? They're misogynists.
They even old-timey.
But they would have no problem with that whatsoever, and that it would ruin a governor's career to discover that he's racist.
I think the funny subtext there that either the Coens are going for just because they want to make you laugh is that music can save the world, or in this case, save three guys' lives, because twice in that sequence towards the end, where Everett's just trying to talk to Penny, Holly Hunter doesn't appear in this movie till about an hour in, something like that, way into the film we finally meet her. She's been in a lot of Coen movies, Raising Arizona, which we covered years ago.
She was Frances McDormand's roommate.
In the early 80s, right?
Yep.
I think the Coens lived there, too. That's how they even met Holly Hunter and Frances McDormand. But Clooney's trying to talk to her while other musical acts are going on. And then, for some reason, Pete and Delmar know to say, "In constant sorrow," and the crowd goes nuts. One of the other funny Clooney reactions in this movie is when he hears that and right away, "Oh, man, I guess I'm on." And the crowd goes crazy. But then when Homer Stokes interrupts it and talks about, "They desecrated a cross," and they did all these things, they literally ride him out of town on a rail, which is a long-time expression that actually happens in this movie. I didn't get that the first time. That's what that's supposed to be.
So they didn't ride him out because he's racist, because he revealed in that moment that he's a member of the KKK.
He's messing with the music.
It's just because they love the Socky Bottom Boys.
Please don't
so
stop
much.
The music. Please don't stop the music.
They're like a bunch of stans on Twitter going after anybody who goes after their
Beyonce.
Person. Yeah, Beyonce or BTS or whatever.
Right. But then after all that scene with Homer, it's right back into the song again. Everybody loves it. The governor realizes, these boys is a hit. And he goes from not caring about them at all to making them part of his brain trust, as Everett reveals later on. And that's why I say in the nutshell that he's going to pardon these dim felons to help him win re-election. They actually run across him a few times, though, because when they have sung into Stephen Root's can and get their money for six guys, only four of them in actuality, they're leaving and telling Papi O'Daniel, a fellow in there will give you money if you sing into his can. But he's going there to broadcast his message, which no one wants to hear because he's way behind Homer Stokes at that point. And he's also in the restaurant when Everett and Delmar are in there with what they think, or at least Delmar thinks, is Pete, the toad. The governor's son and his two lackeys are in that restaurant also. So they run across him three different times in this movie until he finally just uses them. And I don't know that's going to work out too well. You know what? I'll do the what happens next right now because I have a few angles on this whole thing. What happens next in O Brother, Where Art Thou? After that whole thing where they're pardoned, but yeah, we're going to do things my way. Ain't we, boys? That's not what he says, but that's the inclination that you better do things my way or I'll screw you all over again. But what happens next? The unstable Pete performs a coup on Governor Papi O'Daniel when Everett and Delmar aren't paying attention. Governor Hogwallop just might make Mississippi great again. Although he has PTSD from what he's been through, and I think he's ready to blow. My second idea, Delmar is just pretending to be a moron. Tim Blake Nelson's a very smart guy. Syriana, George Clooney movie, they don't share scenes together, but he's in that. Very smart character. Anyway, playing a dummy in this movie, actually smart. He's going to start his own campaign for governor because his last name is O'Donnell. And then O'Daniel, or O'Daniel, is the governor's name. And it's close enough to O'Daniel that the sly guy knows people will vote for him because he's kin to Pappy. Or they at least might think he's kin.
Well, these pessimistic takes do jive with the tone of the film. In a lesser film, the governor would be a good guy who's losing in the polls to somebody who's charismatic but not necessarily a bad governor. But he seems like a bad guy. Both candidates are bad. He just happens to be the one that's going to help them.
These boys is a hit.
So they got lucky and he pardons them because he has the power to because he's still governor. And
but there's a threat there. Ain't you boys?
Yeah, because he's a bad person. There's no winning for the citizens of Mississippi. Both governors are rotten.
And Mississippi is one of the worst off states in so many ways in America, even now. And I'm sure it was back in the Depression. This movie was set, of course, in Mississippi and also shot in Mississippi. Some of it California. We talk about the racial elements. Well, you've got a blind soothsayer in this film because the handcar man describes the entire story. He predicts it. And it all basically comes true. It's a little bit more than a horoscope, but a little bit less than somebody literally saying these things will happen to you. But he does predict the basic story, including the cow on top of the barn. Soon after they get away on the handcar, though, they meet Pete's cousin, who blows their cover. I gotta take care of me and mine! And that puts them in the tight spot. And that's one theme in this movie, too. Every time Everett falls asleep, something bad happens. That happens there. when the three of them are knocked out by the sirens. They loved him up and turned him into a horned toad. He falls asleep there. He falls asleep at other times, and something bad happens every time, it seems. Stay awake, Everett. Soon after, the three guys, well, not the three, actually, but Pete and Delmar are baptized as they go down to the river to pray. That's a good song, too.
It's a good song.
We are not religious, but I like a good religious song if it's effective. We talked about that in Nashville, where you see the contrast between
the,
what's his name, the guy in the beginning who's being a dick to his band, and it cuts to the black choir celebrating God. We see it in Forrest Gump, too. If you're going to be religious, I can get behind that. Not this lash you in the face for daring to think about sex and daring to think about doing anything that's wrong.
And these boring dirges, you know, some of the hymnal music when I was going to church as a kid. God, it was boring.
Pete and Delmar are saved. And then, of course, we find out Tommy sold his soul to the devil. So we get Everett saying, I'm the only one that ain't affiliated. And that is a running theme in this movie. There's a definite religious arc in this movie because until he finally gets down on his knees because they're about to die, they're about to be strung up. Because Sheriff Cooley, who's also predicted, Tommy talks about how the devil is white. He has empty eyes. Sheriff Cooley's got the sunglasses on. Hollow voice, which Daniel von Bargen sort of has. Hound dog, which we see. And then he even says, the sheriff does, the law is a human institution. So he's ignoring what the governor just said. The governor himself, pardon them, it doesn't matter. But until Everett finally submits to the will of God and asks for help, God pities us and saves them. And seems to have washed away everybody else. The only living creatures after that had to have been a dam. That was not a river. That was a dam that burst that washed everything away, like in Deliverance maybe or something. They're saved by, or maybe it's supposed to be a river, but then God made it into a giant tsunami that washes away all those cops and the gravediggers. They didn't do anything wrong, but they get killed apparently. We don't see them again.
And the hound dog.
And the hound dog. We don't see him. We just see the four guys and the cow on top of the barn. That cow is probably going to die. What are they going to do to help that cow?
What's it going to do? Swim away?
It lived for the time being, but it's not going to stay alive.
That cow is screwed. I never really thought about that. Not the first cow to die in this movie.
That was CGI. And apparently the, what's it called? ASPCA?
The Humane Society, I think, is they're the ones that.
They had a problem with that, but then the Coens proved it's just digital effects, which is pretty awesome because 20 years later, that's as well done then as they maybe would do it now. It still looks like they're actually running over a cow. And it's not deliberate. They just don't see the cow coming.
It's very convincing. Another way that the movie has this bleak touch. What comedy in their right mind is going to kill animals? And they do it over and over. They kill the cows. They get shot. They get run over. They kill the toad. At that point, we as the audience have come to have affection for that toad.
Because Delmar thinks it's Pete.
Delmar thinks it's Pete, but so what? It's become a character of the film that we've grown to like and care about. You kill a dog in your movie? An innocent hound dog?
We don't know for sure that it died.
You see him drowning. You see him underwater, flailing about.
With the Dapper Dan cans.
He never surfaces, just like nobody else surfaces. And this is the Coens. Actually, Wes Anderson does this too. He always kills an animal. I think in almost every one of his movies, a cat or a dog dies. It's exactly what a screenwriter would tell you not to do. But it's a great example of the way that these visionary filmmakers can break the rules and make something their own.
It could be intentional too.
Of course it's intentional. They know what they're doing.
This is the Depression, and people are struggling to survive best they can as it is. So an animal, no matter how much you might love that animal.
Oh, not the livestock.
George, not the livestock. It's not deliberate most of the time. It's a dam bursting that drowns the dog. Babyface Nelson. Call me George, not Babyface. Michael Badalucco has a lot of fun in this movie, too.
And another really bleak touch. He's so funny. He's in this manic stage. He's got money flying out.
Terrifying highs. Dizzying lows. No creamy middles.
Any armchair psychologist could tell you that this man has a pretty acute case of bipolar disorder.
He's the Trump of this movie.
Right. But he goes and he robs a bank, and then somebody calls him Babyface, and then that just takes him from the top of Everest to the Marianas Trench of moods, and he wanders off, and then when they see him at the end, he's high again, but he's on his way to the electric chair. And there's like a gang of townspeople cheering his death sentence.
Cow killer!
And he's comic relief, yet he has this tremendously bleak ending. They don't go easy on the audience in this film. There's some bleak touches in Big Lebowski, obviously in Fargo. I think Fargo's trying to end on a downer note and take you down to as serious as possible in certain points of the film. But Oh Brother is absolutely a comedy. It's almost like Fargo is a serious film that happens to be very funny. Oh Brother, Where Art Thou is a comedy that happens to have a very serious story in
it. Often
there.
Vicious.
Oh, yeah, absolutely.
One of the more important lines they've ever written, not one of the great lines, but one of the more important is when Francis McDormand says to Peter Stormare in the cop car towards the end, "I just don't understand it."
All for a little bit of money.
And this movie in some ways is for a bit of money too, because these guys agreed to break out of jail with Everett because they think they're going to get a treasure of hundreds of thousands of dollars. But in the end, the treasure is actually, in a way, a wedding ring that's going to be at the bottom of a lake. And he gets the wrong one, which is partly on Penelope too for telling him the wrong one. Or maybe it's some other place. I don't know.
She's counted the three.
Right. It's actually pretty impressive that these guys could take these kinds of themes and make it funny, isn't it?
There's a reason why they are one of the greatest filmmakers, their generation filmmakers, set of filmmakers, you know what I mean?
The reason that Everett is even in jail, too, and funny that he's on a chain gang, because we don't know what Pete and Delmar did. They talked about being in a jail. I'll be 84 years old. Well, I'll only be 82. Tim Blake Nelson. We haven't raved about him enough. We will soon. We don't know what they did, why they're on a chain gang. They're not black, so it may have been pretty bad, because if you're black, it could have been that they looked at somebody the wrong way. But Everett's crime was practicing law without a license. Why isn't a chain gang for that?
I don't know, because it's Mississippi in the 30s. And we do know why Delmar was in prison, because he says after he's been saved, the preacher told me I've been forgiven,
oh,
even
that's
for
right.
that 7-Eleven I held up. And he's
so
like,
armed
I thought
robbery.
You said you were innocent. Well, I lied, and I'm forgiven for that, too.
John Turturro has the great eyes, and there's something simmering underneath him the whole time. He worked with the Coens so often, although this is the last time that he's worked with them. So many times through the 90s, he's the star of Barton Fink. He's in Big Lebowski, that great scene-stealing role as Jesus the Bowler.
And speaking of scene-stealing, in Miller's Crossing,
right,
he has a performance in that film that might be the best of his career.
Begging for his life. And he's very good in this movie, but as good as Clooney is, and everybody else, Charles Durning, of course, John Goodman, we can go on and on. I think the best thing in the movie is Tim Blake Nelson.
He's so funny.
And it's partly because he's so sweet. Funny, of course, but the sweetness. When they steal the pie, Everett and Pete have stolen a pie off somebody's ledge. Not cool, but you can understand why they would, because they're starving to death. But they've got money, and Pete leaves, whatever it is, a five or something. Even a dollar bill back then would be a lot of money, under a rock in the windowsill. Such a great little touch. It would have taken them 3 seconds to add that to the screenplay, and I love that they did. The "I'll only be 82" line is hilarious. And the
"I'm voting for yours truly. I'm voting for yours truly." Well, I'm with you fellas.
Right. I'm with you fellers. And of course, he is the title character in The Ballad of Buster Scruggs, which got released a couple years ago on Netflix. I think it will always be on there because it's a Netflix production that the Coens did for them. I knew it was an anthology going in, but there's less of him than I might have thought there might be. I thought maybe he'd come back in the thing. He's good in the movie. He sings a song in that movie. He sings his song towards the end. "I'm in the jailhouse now." That's actually Tim Blake Nelson singing. But it's not Clooney singing in Man of Constant Sorrow. He's dubbed by Dan Timinsky, some country blues, whatever, country singer, I guess. Clooney worked on his singing for a long time, but they went with, and probably rightly so, a guy who really sang the hell of that song. I've never heard the original recording. I'm sure it's good, but it's probably not nearly as fun and upbeat and peppy
and
as
it
what's
was
in this movie.
A hit. Anybody who's young listening to this podcast, I could not exaggerate how ubiquitous that song was in the year 2000. It was everywhere. Everybody's mom loved that song.
Yeah, even people that don't like country music or blues or that kind of stuff that's in this movie, they like this soundtrack. They love that song. But we just raved about Nelson, of course, when he says they loved him up and turned him into a horned toad. He was already lovable and funny, but that sequence for the next little while in the restaurant, because Pete's not in the movie for a while, it's just Nelson and Clooney working together, is some of the best stuff he does in the whole film.
Has he ever done anything this good since? He's not really been in that many movies
begin with. He's one of those quintessential character actors because he's been in a lot of movies you might forget he was in. I mentioned Syriana, which I believe is only a couple of scenes, but he has that great one. But he plays 100% opposite of this character. As a modern lawyer, where he's explaining why corruption is good. It's almost the new "greed is good" speech from Wall Street. He directed O, but they pushed it back because of the Columbine tragedy. I think there's killing in that movie, but it's about high school students.
Well, it's based on Othello, so yeah, there's killing in that movie.
But I think it's also a shooting, a school shooting. In any case, kids get killed. Nelson's been in more things than you think. He also is one of the main characters in The Incredible Hulk, a character that's never come back. And people talk about how many characters we might see in the Marvel Universe, the MCU, and the TV series that they might do if we ever can shoot TV shows and movies again in the future. His character is still hanging out there as the Abomination. No, wait, the Abomination? No, that's not it. That's Tim Roth's character. Tim Blake Nelson is the... Someone's going to be hating me for not getting this.
Someone right now is listening to this just saying the word over and over again. It's so frustrating.
But he's supposed to play some kind of giant brain character from the Hulk legacy, and he could still do that.
Oh, he was in The Watchmen as well. Not The Watchmen, just Watchmen, the show.
Right.
And he's quite serious in that. Doesn't do this goofiness very often. Which is such a shame because, like you said, he steals this movie.
Hmm. Also a small scene-stealing moment is the Warby Gals, which should be, of course, the McGill Gals, but he's a suitor, but you ain't bona fide. Two of my favorite lines in Coen Brothers writing history. He's a suitor, and but you ain't bona fide.
Kids are so cute. What a great touch that it's all daughters. He just has seven daughters.
Mean to say this about children, but for George Clooney especially, but even Holly Hunter, also a nice-looking lady, these kids would never be that unattractive.
They could be cuter. Also, they don't...
You said the same thing. These kids are ugly,
okay,
for George Clooney's kids.
I didn't say it on the record, but I guess you're calling it now. Here. I said they could never be siblings. They don't look anything like one another, and they certainly don't look anything like their stage parents.
And those three actresses don't sing the In the Highway song. It's somebody singing for them. But they sure look the part. They're not attractive, but they're still cute, if that makes sense.
They're adorable.
And we've mocked or mimicked, whatever you want to call it, for a long time, both the put up your dukes thing, where your hands are 9 feet away from your face, with Ray McKinnon, who's Vernon T. Waltrip.
How funny that Clooney is a terrible fighter in that scene. Absolutely hopeless.
Gets his ass handed to him. And thrown out, the other thing we've mimicked for a long time is, and stay out of the Woolsworth, which is also on the trailer. I remember that very well.
He's a suitor. That's from Odyssey.
As are sirens.
Yeah. Cyclops. It's Goodman.
Mm-hmm.
There's a treasure.
Do
and it's like
not seek the treasure.
Ulysses, which is Everett's first name, is just another way to say Odysseus. Odysseus?
From the Odyssey.
And the Odyssey is all about a man's journey back to his home and his family.
And Penelope, I believe, is the wife, isn't it?
Yeah, and she has suitors that he has to...
She has suitors. Beat
off. She has over 100 suitors. You know, you say they knew what they were doing, but I read a broad strokes version of the Odyssey to prepare for this. They got some characters that are in the Odyssey. But as far as the plot goes, they are completely doing their own thing. We've got this man who's on a journey. Some things have the same names and somewhat similar motivations, but for the most part, it really does not stick that close to the plot of the Odyssey.
But there are little details that, if they didn't read the Odyssey at all, I'm impressed, because it's more about that than the overarching
theme.
Sure,
but knowing about the Odyssey is like knowing... I've never read the Bible, but I know a lot about the Bible.
I don't know much about the Odyssey.
Okay, I do, though.
From this movie. I'm not asking what you
read...
know. I know what I know.
Oh, okay, fine. But if you're getting all of your knowledge about the Odyssey from this movie, then of course you think this is incredibly loyal to the Odyssey, because you're going to assume that
I looked
Odyssey...
it up years ago, let's put it that way, and saw just how many things are similar.
It just happens that recently I've read two books that were a modern play on the Iliad and then the Odyssey. One called Achilles and one called Circe. From those characters' perspectives. And I read that Margaret Atwood book about Penelope. Those are much more faithful interpretations of the Odyssey than this movie is.
But that's why this movie was nominated for the adapted screenplay for the Coens. First time they'd ever been nominated for that category. Because they generally, then and since, more often than not, have been original screenplay writers. I talked earlier about the religious aspects in this movie. We've been seeing that a lot lately, because one thing we didn't talk about in Harvey... An angle I thought about when I was editing is the rabbit, Harvey, supposed to be God or even a God, but flat out what they think as the Christian God. And in Elwood's version, he's just somebody to hang out with and be friends with, and he's made me a better person. But anyway, there's religious elements in that movie, and obviously in Monty Python and the Holy Grail last week, that's obviously what's going on there, because these guys are going for Jesus' cup from the Last Supper. So we've had a lot of religious backbones in our movies lately, in our comedy month here, funny movie month. Wayne Duvall is Homer, another thing from long ago, the Odyssey type stuff. Homer Stokes, who's the opponent for the current governor, and he's the head of the KKK. He has a mini-me, which I don't know if that was supposed to be a reference to. Well, hang on. Mini-Me was in the first Austin Powers, I think, right? That was 97, so maybe it could have been. But even if it was only the second movie, I forget what the order was with the Austin Powers stuff. But if it was the second movie, it still could have been a reference because that was 99, the second Austin Powers film. And then Wayne Duvall and Ray McKinnon are both in Apollo 13, which we covered earlier this year. That is such a big cast. It's not that surprising that you'd have other actors be in this movie. Daniel Von Bargen, who is Sheriff Cooley, is a journeyman actor, but in a ton of things, including being George's boss on Seinfeld. Doesn't want to call him T-Bone when that's what George wants as a name. But you look up his credits, ton of movies for Daniel Von Bargen. And I mentioned Holy Grail. This is also a quest movie like Holy Grail was. And Wizard of Oz is. There's so many references to Wizard of Oz. And of course, The Odyssey is a quest thing.
It's a great format if you want to make something that's very episodic. Every scene is incredibly fast. The pacing probably works because they're in and out of every scene in like under a minute.
I guess no scene really drags, does it? It's probably not quite as fast as that in some cases. The siren scene is such an odd one. Those three women are so lovely and sexy and as they're supposed to be to draw these guys in. Pete hears them somehow.
He's got the itch.
If I'd cranked up the sound, we might have heard very softly in probably the left side of our screen because I think the car is on the right side of the screen at that point. He tells or demands Everett stop the car and he's the one that runs out. And then he's the one that gets captured, ironically. So it's his fault that he got captured if you think about it. But when they see these three women, they're all just hypnotized. Everett keeps talking because Everett never shuts up. And yet the woman's pouring booze down his throat. If you have to be loved up and think one of your guys is going to be killed, that's maybe the way to go. But Everett is loyal to his wife, so I'm not so sure that he's supposed to have done anything with them. But that's a subtext. There's been lots of movies where it's that dalliance of, well, are you going to play with these women who are trying to get with you? And that's also in The Odyssey, to my understanding at least, the muses.
They're sirens.
Sirens. And they're singing because this is a pseudo-musical.
Yeah, but the sirens do sing the siren song.
Go to sleep, you little baby.
I do love that song.
Oh, yeah.
There's something about people singing in three-part harmony that soothes my soul. Also, just the plaintive sounds of those fiddles. Oh, I just love the music so much. This is a great example of where you have the characters of the sirens. But in the Odyssey, they don't succumb to the sirens. All the members of his crew put wax in their ears so they can't hear him. And they tie Odysseus to the front of his ship so he can't go to the sirens, but he wants to hear the song regardless. The version of the sirens in the movie is maybe mixing that with this story of Circe, where they do meet with Circe and she feeds them and turns his men into swine.
And then sleeps with their brother and tries to kill the other brother? Oh, different Circe.
No, but she does sleep with Odysseus.
Oh.
Yeah, he becomes her lover for a while.
Well, we've talked about the Coens being the writers, directors, and producers of their own projects. They pretty much always have been. They've had other people produce their films sometimes. And occasionally, I think they've had co-writers. But generally, it's been the two of them that have been the true auteurs of their films. We've covered Fargo for the Top 100 Project years ago, The Big Lebowski, very popular podcast for us, as it would be for anybody who does a podcast about that, I think. Raising Arizona, No Country for Old Men, all back in the archives for us. This isn't their best work. It's not in their top five for me, but that doesn't mean it's not very good. It's like saying The Departed is probably not in my top five Scorsese films, but it's still very good. That's how talented these guys are, and they work with the same people over and over again. That's one of the reasons why it works for them. Roger Deakins shot this one like he shot so many of their movies. Carter Burwell scored it like he scored so many movies. They edited their own films, so four jobs for these guys, along with Trisha Cook. They're always credited as Roderick Janes, and Trisha Cook did 12 cut jobs, including on Big Lebowski and The Man Who Wasn't There with these guys. Deakins did some color correction on this movie. It does look great.
Well, this was innovative post-production work. This is the first feature film to do a digital color correct. Back in 2000, they surely would have shot it on 35, and then digitized it and did all of the color changes in the computer instead of with an optical printer.
Which I think always happens now.
100%. Even if you shoot on film, you're doing your color correction digitally. You just have so much more control. It's so much faster and cheaper. And it's better. It's just better.
If Roger Deakins will do it, then it must be fine. He is a true artist.
Was Roger Deakins Roger Deakins in 2000? He was, wasn't he?
Yeah, he'd already been nominated for Shawshank in Fargo. And he'd done so many other great films. He has such a resume, especially with these guys, so many movies they did together. He finally won two Oscars in a row, in fact, for Blade Runner 2049 and then earlier this year for 1917, after not winning so many times, including for the Coens, for all the great work he did with them.
Who could possibly dispute him winning for those films? They are the pinnacle of his life's work.
Or five others.
So, no, it's true. I love Roger Deakins. And the look of this film is so important. They shot it in the summertime, I think, or in the spring. All those trees were green. And they took all the color out. They gave it this sepia tone. Kudos also to the production design, the costume design, the hair and makeup, the way that they always look dirty. Everything looks weather-beaten and sad.
And old.
And tired and old. And the Coens always have this great habit of casting the most interesting actors and extras. People with great character in their faces.
That's my fiancé. Another line we said lots of times over the years when we were still fiancés. That's my fiancé.
In every movie they have a shopkeeper who's very strange and stoic and speaks in monosyllables and has no expression on their face. And I think of the woman who calls George Babyface. And she just has such a face. They create these images. They put these things in front of the camera that are so interesting and unique, and everything jives with the tone and the theme. Maybe this is another thing that takes a movie that people consider to be mediocre, but does rise above some of their other films, in my opinion. And you could just get lost in any frame of this movie.
If you didn't think they were great technical directors after Fargo, and maybe people didn't really think so because they hadn't really been thought of that way in their earlier filmmaking, I don't think. They were more show-offy, like Sam Raimi, their old friend, was with the Evil Dead films. Not that his movies don't look good for the budget, and the old Coen movies don't look great for their budget, too, but it's like the old Scorsese or Tarantino when they got going. They're more about character, they're more about the great scripts or the memorable moments than the technical abilities with the sound and the look.
Gimmicky, impressive ways of shooting a film.
But as all those guys got older, they got to be true artists, Scorsese, Tarantino, the Coens. And this movie is maybe the epitome of that because it looks remarkable. Should have been nominated for the costumes, maybe the sets, but none of those nominations. And of course, the Carter Burwell music. It's more about the songs we know, but he was involved in that soundtrack, worked with them so often, nominated a couple of times since for other people's scores. Carol, which we covered earlier this year, he was nominated for that. Carter Burwell, but all these great scores for the Coens. T-Bone Burnett did the music for this too, and he is a legend now as well. He won an Oscar for, I think it was the song in the Jeff Bridges movie, Crazy Heart. And the movie is 2391. We watched our DVD. I'm sure the Blu-ray is that much better, but the DVD looked really good. And you're agreeing with me. You say the editing, the music were excellent.
I know people nitpick on this movie, but I just don't see it. I wouldn't necessarily call it perfect, but...
No movie's perfect.
It's damn well near.
Okay, then. Coen Brothers have been pretty popular on our channel, so why not cover them 20 years after one of their better movies? Although, as I said, and this is a compliment to how good they've been, this isn't even in my top five. But your last thoughts on Oh Brother.
God, I don't know if I've ever ranked Coen films, but if it's not in my top five, it's six or seven. And to be the seventh best Coen film is to be better than 99% of films that are made. Mm-hmm. God, it is still so funny in a way that I think is really going to age well and last for a long time. It makes me laugh more today than I think it did when I first saw it.
Maybe it is in their top five, at least. It's just that Fargo, No Country, and Lebowski are so far ahead of everything else. But I really like The Man Who Wasn't There, love Barton Fink. I like Raising Arizona, not as much as you. Blood Simple.
Llewyn Davis. God, I love that
Inside
Llewyn
Davis. That's why. See, there you go. I think maybe that doesn't quite get past those. But as far as pure laughs goes, it's not far behind Lebowski and not far behind Fargo. Because like you said, that is the trilogy, whether it was meant that way or not. And in the span of just a few years, 96, 98, 2000. And it doesn't matter about Oscars, I guess. These guys probably didn't even care. They'd won one for Fargo, but their movies were so unrewarded and really so unwatched. Fargo did fine for a small budget film. Big Lebowski did not. This did pretty well. But why aren't people going to see these movies? Maybe it's marketing. Maybe it's the weirdness. Clooney wasn't George Clooney with big capital letters at that point.
Also, we kind of have to remind ourselves sometimes, most people don't share our taste in movies. Most people, if they happen to catch this podcast, would hear us say that this movie is better than How to Lose a Guy in 10 Days and be flabbergasted.
Or My Best Friend's Wedding.
The vast majority of people would rather watch one of those movies.
And they'll laugh more than they will at this.
Totally. So that's the answer, that our taste is not the popular taste.
But a lot of fun. Glad we saw it. And it is our fourth of five movies in Funny Movie Month. We'll wrap that up next week on November 30th, and we'll put a big Christmas bow on Funny Movie Month as we cover a Christmas film leading into the holiday season, Home Alone, which is funny. And I'm going to have a lot of thoughts about other things in that movie, as other people do. including the coming attractions trivia for the picture. Which movie character do people think Kevin McAllister grew up to become? So he's a character, and which character did he become?
All right, so for the answer to that question, check out next week's podcast about Home Alone. In the meantime, check out our website, top100project.com. And don't forget to favorite or subscribe to us wherever you listen. All of our episodes are available for free. That includes all 123 movies that made the AFI's 98 and or 2007 list of the best American films ever made, and hundreds more titles, and perhaps in exchange for all of this great content. You could leave us a rating and a review. If you'd like to reach us, we're both on Twitter. I'm at Bev Ellis Ellis, and Ryan is at MovieFiend51. Or you can reach us by email, top100projectpodcast@gmail.com. And to enjoy freshly roasted premium coffee delivered straight to you in Canada or the US, please go to sparkplugcoffee.com and use the promo code TOP100PROJECT. And that's all one word, TOP100PROJECT. It's not case sensitive, and that will get you a 20% discount.
The podcast is over, so it's time for us to RUNNOFT
and cut.
I was the man of podcast magic. I sing too many times on this channel. Down, 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 down. Play it, Tommy. Play us out.